From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The U.S. government is ready to spend 10 years and $100 million to find out if we're alone in the universe. Frank White has written a new book on the scientific search for extraterrestrial intelligence. On this edition of Fresh Air, is anyone out there? Also, Ann Magnuson talks about crossing over from performance art to sitcom. She's the magazine editor in the series Anything But Love, but she still does performance art. We'll hear an excerpt of her latest piece. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Arnold Schwarzenegger's latest movie, Kindergarten Cop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House announced that it's sending Secretary of State James Baker on a last effort to meet with Iraqi leaders in Switzerland. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says Baker will go to Europe January 6th for several days of close consultations with coalition partners, and that he will be available to meet with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz in Switzerland between January 7th to the 9th. Fitzwater read a statement by Mr. Bush saying this is the last attempt to go the extra mile for peace.
This offer is being made subject to the same conditions as the president's previous attempt. No negotiations, no compromises, no attempts at face-saving, and no rewards for aggression.
The announcement came minutes before Mr. Bush was to begin consultations with congressional leaders on the Persian Gulf. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Democratic leaders said today that Congress will forego its usual January recess and remain on standby in case members are needed to debate a resolution on the Persian Gulf crisis. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and House Speaker Thomas Foley made the announcement after a meeting with the president. The two said that any debate should take place after Secretary of State Baker returns from his latest round of meetings on the Gulf crisis. The president has said he'd like to see Congress vote quickly on a narrowly drawn resolution supporting UN and U.S. efforts to force Iraq out of Kuwait. Kuwaiti Ambassador Sheikh Saud Nasir al-Sabah welcomed news of a possible meeting between Secretary of State Baker and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
Following a meeting with Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato, the Kuwaiti ambassador said he supports the new offer for talks, provided that it's made clear that no concessions or rewards will be offered to Iraq.
This is another step that the president has taken and has been termed as another extra mile. And let's hope that we don't run out of mileage here, that it's up to the Iraqis now to respond.
Senator D'Amato also voiced his support for the Bush proposal, calling it a bold move.
Well, I applaud it. I don't think it's blinking. I think, indeed, it is a manifestation of his desire to see a peaceful resolve, if at all possible.
D'Amato says he hopes Congress will not attempt to undercut the president's policy in the Gulf. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
A senior French lawmaker arrived in Baghdad today on what's being described as an unofficial peace mission. The French government assured allies that Michel Vozel was simply on an informational visit and had no authority to negotiate. Vozel, a close advisor to President François Mitterrand, is chairman of the French National Assembly's Foreign Affairs Commission. He's scheduled to meet with Iraqi Foreign Minister Aziz and the Iraqi House Speaker. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 37 points today to close at 2,573.5. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Not everyone who thinks there might be extraterrestrials out there is a kook. NASA will begin a search for extraterrestrial intelligence in 1992. My guest, Frank White, has written a new book about the scientific search for life beyond Earth. It's called the SETI Factor. SETI is an acronym for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The book also speculates how our view of life on Earth would change if scientists did make contact with life on other planets. White is a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton, New Jersey. He and Isaac Asimov co-authored the book The March of the Millennia. White believes that NASA's project is one of the most significant steps yet in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Having a major agency like NASA involved symbolically says this is a reasonable scientific effort. Public funds can be spent on it. It's worth doing. But at another level, it's significant because the biggest difference between this search and others is really in the computer equipment that's being used. They will be using existing radio telescopes, but they're creating a very complex new computer system that will be able to discriminate in a much more complete way the kinds of information that's coming from the galaxy to the radio telescope than in the past, so that they'll be able to look more carefully and more broadly at the kinds of signals that are coming in. There's a lot of noise, there's a lot of information that you can pick up if you point a radio telescope at the sky. The critical issue is, what is an artificial signal? How can you tell an artificial signal? And how can you look at enough frequencies to know that you've really done a good search? So the biggest difference really is in the power of the computing machinery. There is a fairly powerful search going on right now that's privately sponsored by the Planetary Society. And they have a site up here in Massachusetts, and they have another one down in South America. Again, the NASA search is going to be technologically more powerful. Also, it's going to be funded for something like 10 years. So the significance here is that if there is extraterrestrial intelligence, if they want to be in communication with us, within our lifetimes, we may well be in contact with them. So it's very significant that something might happen in the near future.
You raised the question before, how can transmission equipment or radio telescopes discriminate between random noise and pre-existing signals with with intelligently made signals. So is this new computer equipment designed to discriminate?
Well, the equipment is going to be using a lot of sophisticated software so that it'll basically be programmed, and it'll say, if you see this kind of signal, ignore that, because that is just the galaxy making static. If you see the next kind of signal, ignore that. That's probably man-made, or it's probably human in origin. It's probably coming from Earth. And then there will be other formulas that will say, now, if you see this signal, call a human. Get a person to come look at this, because this is something that is apparently neither natural nor Earth-originating. And the other key thing that hasn't been done by most searches in the past is this equipment will also have an ability to lock on, stay with a signal, and keep looking at it over a period of time. In the past, some of the searches have actually located signals that look like what the scientists were looking for, but when they went back and looked for it later, they couldn't find it. Or because of the way the equipment was set up, they couldn't go back for quite a while and look for it. So there have been some signals that have been detected which looked interesting, to put it mildly, but they didn't repeat. And this new equipment is going to have an ability to stay targeted on the signals for a longer period of time.
If a signal is detected and it's only detected once and it cannot be duplicated, it's never found again, is it dismissed? Or is there a certain number of times a signal has to be registered, received, before it's taken seriously as a possible message from intelligent life?
Well, the criterion that the scientists have set up is that it has to have a certain pattern, which is called a bold spike. And it's a wave that clearly stands out against the background of static and natural noise. So that's one criterion. And then the other one is, if you can't go back and pick it up later, the next day or whatever, it is dismissed in the sense of it's assumed that it is something that we can't explain, but it's not a signal that's aimed at us, and it's just called an anomaly. So it's an interesting question. I think basically the scientists feel that if it doesn't repeat, and if you have limited resources, there's no real value in going back and trying to figure out what these signals are. But they are a mystery. They're called anomalies, and I think that's a good word for them.
Frank White is my guest. He's an author, consultant, and a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton. He's written several books on space exploration. His new book is called The SETI Factor, How the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence is Revolutionizing Our View of the Universe and Ourselves. There has actually been a protocol established for what to do if a signal is received. Who established the protocol? And then you can describe what it is for us.
Well, the protocol is a very interesting document because it is one of the first conscious efforts to deal with the impact of contact. It's the effort to bring some social science into what is mostly a physical scientific experiment. At some of the early conferences in the 80s, when people were first starting to talk about what would happen if we got a signal, they and some other people who were involved in the field decided there should be a procedure that all SETI researchers around the world would follow if you were sitting at your equipment and suddenly you were successful, you got something. Obviously, that would be an important moment, and the first thing you'd want to do would be to make sure it wasn't a false alarm. So the first thing you have to do, really, is get confirmation from other sites, replicate the experiment. With the NASA project, they're also going to load new software in to make sure that at the next observing period, they have fresh software and what they were seeing wasn't being caused by the computer itself. There's been talk of setting up a contact verification committee. The idea here would be, even after you've gotten technological confirmation that you think there's something here, you'd have a group of experts sit down and say, yes, we really do believe this is a signal that is artificial in nature, it's coming from outside the planet Earth, and it's meaningful. Once you've gone through all of those processes, you begin to move toward an announcement phase. And the principle there is that they want to make the information available immediately. There's a lot of concern that the information not be suppressed, that people trust the information, that it come out from a credible source, and that it be seen as the property of humanity, not of any one nation.
Well, say we were to receive a signal that scientists really believed was coming from intelligent life, mm-hmm. in another galaxy or in outer space somewhere, what possibilities would there be of communicating with that life? I mean, would there be any chance of doing that, or would that just be a signal, we'd register it, there'd be news about it, and you know, then nothing?
Well, one of the things I tried to think about in this book was, in terms of the impact on us, don't we have to think about where is the signal coming from and what is the nature of the signal, which is really the question you're asking. For example, maybe it's just a signal and it has no information content to it. Well, what do we learn from that? We learn a lot. We learn that we're not alone in the universe as an intelligent species. There's another one out there. They're not saying much to us, but they're sending us a message that they're there. We know where they are. We can tell how far away they are. And probably we would anticipate hearing more from them. On the other hand, the situation changes very dramatically if there's a lot of information. What if there's a signal that says, stand by, we will now transmit all the knowledge that our planet possesses? This would be dramatically different. So volume of information is pretty important. The other question about dialogue has to do with how far away are they. NASA's going to be looking at 1,000 stars within 100 light years of us. That means some of these planets could be within 5 or 10 light years, which means it would take that long for us to send a message back. It would take that long for them to respond. So the dialogue would be a bit slow, but at least it would be possible. I mean, we could get a message from a star system 25,000 or 100,000 light years away, and within our lifetime, we could never communicate with them. So all impact won't be the same. It will really depend on the nature of the signal, how far away they are. It's also going to depend on how soon we receive it. The more prepared we are for it, the better we'll be able to conduct a dialogue. For example, if it happened tomorrow, I would say we're really not ready.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and the acronym for that search is SETI. My guest is Frank White, author of the new book, The SETI Factor. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frank White. He's a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton, author of several books on space exploration, including the latest, The SETI Factor. Scientists are pretty divided over our chances of actually finding intelligent life out in space. I mean, they're divided over the possibility of the existence of intelligent life. Let's talk a little bit about both sides of that argument. On one side is the theory that's become known as the assumption of mediocrity.
Yeah, this is, I have said before, I think that's a poor name for it because it doesn't quite communicate what's being said. But what they're trying to say is evolution happens much the same way everywhere in the universe, far as we can tell. So what we see happening on Earth, if you have another planet, anything like Earth, you should see the same scenario. Therefore, you should expect an Earth-like planet to produce intelligent life like ourselves. That's the assumption of mediocrity. The Sun is a very ordinary star. There are literally billions of Sun-like stars in our galaxy alone, and there are billions of galaxies. So the assumption of mediocrity really argues from the numbers that are available to us that life is probably very abundant, so is intelligent life, and so contact is at least a reasonable possibility. It's interesting, this is a scientific theory that's enunciated by people like Carl Sagan, but actually, Terry, I think most people I've talked to who know nothing about the subject start from that assumption. They just start from the fact that, hey, there are so many stars out there. There must be planets. If there are planets, there must be life and intelligence, and it's very arrogant of us to think we're the only ones.
And what's the principle that argues the other side?
Well, that's the cosmic anthropological theory. Basically, that argument says, no, there's nothing in the numbers to indicate that life is abundant or intelligence is abundant. They point out quite forcefully that we don't really know if there are planets around other stars yet. Therefore, we don't know how many planets a star would have, and we don't know whether life would necessarily be a frequent appearance on these planets or not. They also point out that going from life to intelligence is quite a leap that we don't totally understand yet. We're not sure why it happens. We're not sure why it happened in our case. So their argument is, hey, it might take an entire galaxy worth of material to produce one species like humanity. And the other argument they make, which is interesting, is that if intelligent life had developed elsewhere, they would be here. They would have sent probes. They would have, in some way, made their presence known. And I have to say, on my own part, these two arguments are both logical in their own way. And before I started writing the book, I was really a proponent of the assumption of mediocrity. I just assumed that the galaxy and the universe were probably populated by civilizations. But After reading more about the other school of thought, I could see that their arguments were awfully cogent as well.
Are there any other compelling arguments, pro or con, that you know of?
Well, there is a kind of a middle ground between the two, and there might be life flourishing in many planets, but that would not necessarily mean that there would be intelligent life. And moreover, you could have intelligent life that would never reach the point where it would start communicating with us. Moreover, you might have intelligent life that would reach the kind of high technological phase we're in. They would be able to communicate, but through nuclear disaster or ecological collapse, two things that we face, those civilizations might disappear. So there's another argument that says, well, somewhere in between cosmic anthropological principle and the assumption of mediocrity, there is this idea that some civilizations might even have gotten started and eventually destroyed themselves, or they might have chosen not to go down the path that we've gone. They might not really have any interest in communicating with us. And so that's a kind of a middle ground.
My guest is Frank White, and he's an author, consultant, and a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton. He's the author of several books about space exploration, and his latest is called The SETI Factor. SETI is an acronym for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Isn't it possible that if there really was extraterrestrial intelligence out there that we wouldn't recognize it because it would look nothing like life as we know it?
This is an insight that I think a lot of people have had, and it's why I've said that we aren't really searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, but we're really searching for extraterrestrial intelligence like ourselves. We're assuming life arises on planets exclusively. We're assuming that intelligence should be defined by having big brains like ours, that it is packaged, let us say, in the way that we are. And of course, these are assumptions based on one case. Some people have pointed out that it's quite possible that intelligence could be embodied in swarms of microorganisms that are floating between the stars and have learned to live in free space. Some people have suggested that planets may have a form of intelligence. I mean, we're just now beginning to look at the Earth as a living organism. So, yeah, my view, having gone through this process of thinking about it, is I really think there is extraterrestrial intelligence. I think the question exactly is, what is its packaging?
Are Earthlings beaming any kind of information to outer space so that if there is intelligent life there, they could find our signals and discover us? Because we're expecting intelligent life to be beaming messages to us.
Yeah. Well, in terms of intentional messages, one of the outcomes of the protocol movement has been that people have realized that we really have an ethical question of who has the right to do that kind of communication. And people have concluded that if we got a message, we don't really have an international body that's authorized to respond. But similarly, we really don't have anyone authorized to speak for Earth by sending information out there. Now, there was an experiment done where a message was sent to a region 25,000 light years from here. It was sent by one of the more powerful radio telescopes. And the feeling there was that it was going to a region so far away, it couldn't do any harm. Also, one of the Voyager spacecraft has a message on it. That is to say, it's like a CD disc that has greetings from people on Earth, songs, some representation of what life on Earth is about, and a drawing showing where we are and what we look like. But basically, I think it makes sense, there's been kind of a conservative approach to announcing our presence. One final point, though, is that all the radio and television signals, including this show, are radiating out from the Earth, out into the galaxy. And one of the reasons people are kind of optimistic that the extraterrestrials might contact us is that some of those programs have now reached stars 10, 20, 30, 40 light years away. So it may be known, if there are civilizations out there, they may well know that we exist, and they may know a lot about us. They can watch our news shows, they can listen to our radio programs, they could study our culture pretty completely.
I hope they get better reception than we get in Center City.
Yeah, I hope so.
A lot of people wonder, with homelessness the way it is in America today, with poverty the way it is in America, how can you justify spending a lot of money searching for extraterrestrial intelligence? How would you justify it?
Well, I think that question can be applied to the space program as a whole. And I guess what I've concluded is that society always invests a certain amount of its resources in learning more about the nature of the universe and the nature of our planet and the nature of ourselves. And that's always worthwhile, because in many instances, without being able to predict how it will help life on Earth, it turns out that it does. And you have to have an exploring society, I think, an expansive society that's interested in more than what's immediately before it, to really be creative enough to solve problems like homelessness and poverty. So my answer is that I don't think we should spend so much money on space exploration that we don't deal with these problems, but that it's reasonable to invest a small amount. And a key thing about SETI is that this NASA project is only going to be about $100 million over a 10-year period. So compared to a lot of other programs, it's really relatively inexpensive. And the results, I mean, we really haven't talked about this, but think about if we were able to begin communication with a society that's, say, a few hundred years in advance of us, or 1,000 years, we may be able to make quantum leaps in our understanding of medical issues, organizing our society. We really don't know what it would be like to have that kind of influx of new information, but the payoff could be enormous.
Frank White, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Frank White is the author of The SETI Factor. Next time, the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times, Joel Brinkley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On the sitcom Anything But Love, Anne Magnusson stars as a trendy magazine editor, but in her performance art, she satirizes the trendiness of popular culture. Coming up, a performance and interview with Anne Magnusson. And he's got the biggest muscles in movies, but how does Arnold Schwarzenegger handle a classroom full of kids? Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Schwarzenegger's latest movie, Kindergarten Cop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, congressional leaders have announced that lawmakers will not have a recess this month, but will be on call in order to respond quickly to developments in the Persian Gulf. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell has run into some opposition, though, on his intention to hold off debate in Congress until after Secretary of State Baker's proposed meeting with the Iraqi foreign minister, should it take place. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
After meeting with the president, congressional leaders headed back up to the Capitol for swearing-in ceremonies. But Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell ran into trouble as soon as he got to the Senate floor. During a procedural discussion, two Democrats, Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa and Senator Brock Adams of Washington, blasted him for seeking to cut off debate on the Gulf. Mitchell had asked that members wait till after a proposed meeting between Secretary of State Baker and Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz, which was announced this morning. Harkin, angering Mitchell, pressed for immediate debate.
We are here today. Our troops are in Saudi Arabia. Now is the time to debate it. It's being talked about in coffee shops, in workplaces, in homes, in plants and factories all over America. And yet we can't discuss and debate it today or tomorrow.
The majority leader said he welcomed such a discussion, but said it would be more informed after the proposed meeting with Iraq. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
According to the Pentagon, the number of Iraqi troops in and near occupied Kuwait has now gone over the 530,000 mark. Officials say that the multinational force in the Persian Gulf is now more than 580,000, including 335,000 U.S. military personnel. A spokesman says that 20,000 more Iraqi troops have apparently been moved into Kuwait and southern Iraq over the last week. The British government has ordered the expulsion of 75 Iraqis from Great Britain, citing the threat of possible terrorist attacks. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
The expulsion order includes 8 members of Iraq's embassy in London and 67 other Iraqis living here. The members of the embassy have been given 24 hours to leave. Their families must depart within a week. The British Foreign Office based its move on threats Iraq has made to launch terrorist attacks in the West should war break out in the Gulf. It is clearly prudent to take all precautions, a Foreign Office representative said. But the British government gave no evidence that it suspected any of those it has expelled of planning specific acts of terrorism. Most of the 67 non-diplomats are believed to be students. There are a reported 6,000 Iraqi citizens living in Great Britain. This decision today raises the possibility that Baghdad will take retaliatory measures against British diplomats in Iraq. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 37 points to close at 2,573.51 on volume of some 141 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Actress Anne Magnusson has said, "As much as I'm influenced by the French playwrights Alfred Jarry and Eugenie Ionesco, my roots are more in the Andy Griffith Show." Her roots are also in the downtown Manhattan performance scene that evolved in the late 70s. But she's one of the few, if not the only, actress who has crossed over from there to a TV sitcom. You may know her as the eccentric editor Catherine on Anything But Love, which returns later this year as a mid-season replacement. She also starred opposite John Malkovich in the movie Making Mr. Right. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is hosting a performance series in conjunction with its exhibit High and Low, Modern Art and Popular Culture. Anne Magnusson and her band Bongwater performed there and were recorded by the museum. We'll hear an excerpt of their show, then speak with Anne Magnusson. In this excerpt, Magnusson does a character obsessed with the late Jim Morrison, the leader of the rock group The Doors.
This is to inform you that Jim Morrison is alive and well and living within me, his cosmic mate Rhea, and 4-year-old son Jesse Blue James in Staten Island. His initial rising was in May 1979. Jim has evolved into a state of pure energy and can materialize and dematerialize at will. We are the first human examples of cosmic mate materialization. We are under divine guidance and are part of a divine plan. Jim could drink a whole quart of Jack Daniels, two quarts of Jack Daniels, and still put on an incredible show. Wow, he must have had some kind of stomach, huh? And drugs, he could do an unbelievably amount of drugs and still put on an incredible show. He was a genius. He read books. I met this guy who went to UCLA Film School with Jimbo. Wow. What would Jim have thought if you had said back then that he would be the subject of a major motion picture directed by an Oscar-winning Vietnam vet? How ironic, huh? That he would be canonized forever on celluloid, the highest honor society can bestow on an artist. Anyway, so I really did meet this guy who went to UCLA Film School with Jim, and he told me the story that they were taking lights from one building to another building, and as they were rolling them along, Jim stopped in his tracks and he stared at this flying squirrel that was impaled on a stake on top of the chain link fence. And he stood there and he cocked his head to one side, you know, with his neck muscles bulging out real sexy. And he looked at that old flying squirrel, the guts hanging out and the flies buzzing around it, and he said, "Well, I guess that just about says it all." Jim Morrison died in a bathtub in Paris, and it was my dream to make a pilgrimage to see his grave. So I got a job as a cocktail waitress at the Sheraton and had to put up with all sorts of humiliations, but I robbed them blind and got the airfare and went to Paris and went right to Père Lachaise and asked the guard, "Where is Jim?" And he said, "Follow the signs." "Signs? What signs?" "Inside, much graffiti. Hypodermic needles shaped as arrows. Light my fire. Jim this way." We followed them, and an empty beer bottles and cans of wine bottles led us to Jim, the gravesite. A bust had been erected with his long, beautiful, what's that cut that J.C. Bring gave him before he got murdered by the Manson family? What's his name? Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great hair, and somebody had lined his eyes with black and his lips with red, and he looked like Cher. And there were all these Germans tripping around us. And I took an Instamatic snapshot, and I stood and I looked at that grave, and I thought about Jim, and it suddenly dawned on me, what an asshole. I mean, he was an alcoholic, he was a junkie, he was a misogynist, he was fat when he died.
Fat when he died in the pants.
Those leather pants were vinyl. Vinyl! I have this from a very good source.
His hair. What about his hair?
A wig. And his lizard poetry stunk. Plus, I know this hairdresser who does Richard Lewis's hair. Kind of that same thing going on. And she used to be an old rock and roll groupie, and she used to hang out at the Roxy or the Whiskey or one of those places. And she told me that she was there one time in the 60s, late 60s, and she was with her best girlfriend, who was this beautiful Oriental girl. And they were just in there one afternoon. Nobody else was in there except Jim Morrison was right behind them. And he was drunk on wine.
Yuck.
And for no reason, he turned around and he punched the Oriental girl in the stomach. What a jerk! Yeah, I should have stood in bed.
Anne Magnuson performing at the Museum of Modern Art. Are the groupie characters that you do based on women you've known personally, or is it something more based on your own, like, former fantasies?
Well, I think every young girl who grew up in the 70s had a little bit of a groupie in her. But I don't really see those characters as groupie characters, per se. I think they're people like a lot of Americans who are obsessed with celebrities and how to get to know them or how to become one, or somehow feeling that these people lead better lives than they do.
For our listeners who haven't seen your performances, would you describe some of the other characters that you've done over the years in your performances?
Well, let's see. The strange thing is, the characters are becoming less satirical than they used to many years ago. It's hard for me to remember what I did last week, let alone 5 years ago. But I did one performance in the early 80s when Tammy Baker was still only a cable personality and didn't have quite the national exposure that they got later. But I did a show where I portrayed her, and she gets hit on the head in the course of Christian aerobics, gets knocked out, gets caught in between the channels of cable television, has to go from channel to channel, assuming the identities of each format in search of the Christian Broadcasting Network. And it becomes progressively more surreal until she finds herself in hell and breaks on through to the other side to the an Emmy Award celebration, where she sings Stairway to Heaven and receives an Emmy Award.
How did you first get to New York?
Well, it was part of, I went to school in Ohio at Denison University, which I didn't care for much at all. I didn't really want to go to school, but I didn't want to go to work either. So I went to school. I went to London for my junior year abroad, and I went back in my senior year and just hated it so much that I figured out a way to spend the last semester of my senior year in New York on a work-study program, and I went there and worked at the Ensemble Studio Theater, which is an off-Broadway theater uptown, and spent all my evenings down at CBGB's going to see the Ramones and Patti Smith, and although they only came in for special appearances by that point, the Dead Boys were kind of the regular house band there, and just start hanging out downtown and getting to know all the different other suburban refugees who were interested in becoming artists and musicians and performers and fashion designers, and got involved in that creative explosion that was going on downtown the late 70s and early 80s.
How did you start doing performance art? And before I go any further, I should ask you what you think of the term performance art. I think at this point the term has been as maligned as the term mime. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it has.
Yeah.
Well, I never really personally ever called myself a performance artist. I was doing things in nightclubs, and a fellow I knew booked me at the Kitchen, I think it was 81 or something, and then I discovered that by calling yourself a performance artist, you could get gigs in other venues besides nightclubs, and people wouldn't throw bottles at you. So I thought, well, what the heck? If it gets me to Japan, I'll be a performance artist. But I also, because I was doing things that were much more entertainment-oriented, because I put a heavy dose of silliness into my shows, the woman who was running the Kitchen at the time, after she saw my program, went directly to the person who was booking their touring program and insisted that I be taken off of it.
Well,
because I got a little bit of flack there at one point because I guess because it was more of cabaret, and there was sort of a backlash against that kind of thing, infiltrating the high art of performance, the performance world, which was basically in the let's watch paint dry mode.
When you started performing, it was during the punk rock days, and audiences for punk bands, well, it wasn't uncommon for them to throw things at a band or spit at a band. Did you get any of that kind of reaction yourself when you would perform to some of the same people?
Yeah, except I think the punk thing had dwindled a bit by the time I got to New York. I mean, when I was in London, that's when the Sex Pistols were happening, and that was pretty exciting to be around that when it was first going on. But I remember I had a heavy metal band called Vulcan Death Grip, and we played the Ritz one night, but we were put on the bill. We were opening for Jesus and Mary Chain, which is a band that I think the fans of that band are not the kind that would enjoy a heavy metal parody, which I never saw it as a parody. It was a parody for about the first hour. We got into it. We enjoyed it so much that it just ended up being an excuse to actually be heavy metal musicians. But I got attacked on stage. A woman jumped up and pulled my wig off And I was left kind of bawled on stage, so I jumped in the audience after her, and I had these sausages in my hands, which were props for a song we did called Pig Squeal in Fear. And I jumped in the audience, and I found her, and I shoved the sausages in her mouth, and didn't retrieve the wig, but did retrieve my honor up to a point, and until the roadies started beating everybody up, it got kind of ugly, and that was the last time I performed with Vulcan Death Grip.
You were afraid of the audience reaction after that? Or did you think you had gone too far?
I got a little violent for me. But also, I was tired of doing it. I was ready to move on to the next thing anyway.
Which was what?
Oh, what was it? I don't remember. Feature films. Now I'm ready to do Vulcan Death Grip again. It's a lot safer. It's a lot saner.
Actress and performance artist Anne Magnuson is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Anne Magnuson is my guest. A lot of our listeners will know you from your role as the editor, Catherine, in the TV series Anything But Love. That starred Jamie Lee Curtis and Richard Lewis. Describe your character for any of our listeners who hadn't seen it.
Well, you should rant funny face in the first 5 minutes. Kay Thompson does a number called Think Pink, and that was a... That sort of is my guiding light, that image of her going through that number. Well, Peter Noah, the producer, came to me with the idea that the character would be vaguely based on Tina Brown or Anna Wintour, who are the editors of Vanity Fair and Vogue. And I do write magazine articles, and I have had contact with those kinds of people, know a lot of journalists, and got some good stories about crazed editors, and threw all that into the pot. And she's a very eccentric, trend-oriented, information-addled individual who has, instead of a joy of life, I call it a joy of trend. So she's a bit of a satire on the state of the media right now.
Jules, be a dear and get me a cup of tea. I have something very important to share. I've begun therapy. And it has completely changed my outlook. You can expect kinder, gentler editing from this day forward.
Speaking of that, I'd like to talk to you about my column.
Of course, Mike. Didn't you like the changes?
Well, no.
That'll be fine. Let's discuss it in my office.
Hold on. Is there some reason why you just went off in my face?
Oh, yes, I suppose I should explain. Friedrich practices scream therapy. I scream whenever I'm upset. It makes the tension vanish like that.
We're out of English breakfast, so I brought you Earl Grey.
That'll be fine. Come along, Mike.
I've always thought you looked a lot like the young Shirley MacLaine around the Some Came Running era, but I realize now that I'm not alone in thinking that. As a matter of fact,
because I'm the illegitimate love child of Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
But he won't return my phone calls. My mom was she was an exchange student in Italy while he was doing the Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone. And he took her for a wild night in a cheap pensione near the Spanish Steps. I just found this out recently, and I've written a letter to him through the LA Weekly, but he hasn't responded.
Have your Los Angeles experiences and your TV experiences given you more ideas for characters to do in your solo performances?
Well, Sort of, but I don't... Really, in the long run, I don't think a lot of people you run into the Hollywood scene are that interesting. I mean, I think that ground has been plowed so many times. I don't think we need to see anything else about how superficial the Hollywood scene is.
What are some of the stereotypes do you think that people in Los Angeles and in television have of performance artists who got their start downtown New York?
Oh, brother. I think the problem is that people, and it's so easy to make jokes about performance artists because, let's face it, some of them are, you know, pretty ridiculous, myself included. But I think I think people are threatened. You know, I think people in the, straight mainstream Hollywood world are threatened by performance art, and the best of which is far more interesting than anything that will ever be on television or in the movies. I mean, people are really trying to, you know, investigate important issues, and those are things that television just can never touch. So I think they're threatened by it, and I also think that then there's a reverse prejudice against people in the East Village who feel that if you have anything to do with mainstream movies that you've sold out in some way. And I think both points of view are very narrow-minded. And I think as long as people continue to dislike those who are different from they are, that we're never going to make any headway.
Well, Anne Magnuson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Actress Anne Magnuson. Here's music from Too Much Sleep, her recent CD with her band Bongwater.
Talent is a vampire, talent is a whore. Talent is American, always wanting more. That which doesn't kill, more is for the mill.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. There's a Bush administration proposal that Secretary of State Baker meet in Geneva, Switzerland with Tariq Aziz of Iraq. The offer is being praised around the world. Iraq says the plan is under consideration. Israel opens a consulate in Moscow. NPR's Ann Cooper has that story. Our series about cultural diversity in America's schools continues. John Burnett tells us about a school in Texas that has a multicultural program. We'll talk with a Utah State patrolman about an accident there yesterday morning, about 50 vehicles piled up in the fog, and letters from listeners about Santa Claus and women bullfighters.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Arnold Schwarzenegger has starred in movies as a barbarian, several cops, and an extraterrestrial. But film critic Stephen Schiff says Schwarzenegger's role in Kindergarten Cop is his most alien.
About 6 years ago, around the time of his best movie, The Terminator, I met Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he said something interesting to me. "I'm an actor," he said. "I don't always have to play cops or Conan or monsters. I could play a kindergarten teacher." To which I might have replied, "Not bloody likely." That is, if the guy I was talking to didn't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger is not an actor, and Not Bloody Likely is the premise of Kindergarten Cop, in which Arnold does indeed play a kindergarten teacher. It's the very unlikelihood of this big, inflexible lug facing all those little ones that made someone think this was a great idea for a movie. The someone is director Ivan Reitman, who keeps the film zipping smoothly along as it tries to be all things to all people. It's a police thriller, a kiddie comedy, a love story, a buddy picture. The idea is that Schwarzenegger is the toughest cop in Los Angeles, only now, in order to convict the drug kingpin he's been after for years, he has to travel to small-town Oregon. There he must go undercover and pose as a kindergarten teacher, the better to ferret out the drug kingpin's ex-wife and son, who've changed their names and gone into hiding. Arnold needs them to build his court case. Naturally, the fearless cop is flummoxed by the kids. That's the movie's central joke. Take, for instance, this scene in which he tries to figure out which child's daddy is the bad guy.
"Now we're going to do something extremely fun.
We're going to play a wonderful game called Who is My Daddy and What Does He Do? Yes?
Is your daddy a fireman? He's probably big. Is he a wrestler?
Is he a basketball coach?
No.
What's the matter?
Oh, I have a headache.
It might be a tumor.
It's not a tumor. It's not a tumor at all.
You can tell this movie is a stretch for Arnold. Just talking in sentences is a stretch for Arnold. And when he has to read A.A. Milne to his little charges and get all smoochy with the teacher down the hall, played by Penelope Ann Miller, well, Arnold has always looked better with an Uzi in his arms than with a leading lady. Still, there's something about this phony, completely manipulative movie that works. Part of it has to do with weird undercurrents. For instance, the drug kingpin is played by an uncommonly vivid actor named Richard Tyson, who looks like Kurt Russell's evil twin. And the movie's neatest trick is to make him a mama's boy. His ghastly mother is played to the hilt by Carol Baker. And so the film has this odd subtext about child-rearing. The kingpin's mom has literally spoiled him rotten, while Arnold's big lesson is learning that kids need tough love. Too tough for my tastes. What finally turns Arnold into a great teacher is his discovery that paramilitary methods work. Once he gets out his police whistle and starts marching the children around like little commandos, not to mention little Terminators, they all just adore him. Kindergarten Cop isn't a good movie by any means, and it's certainly not for kids. But if the gooey holiday season has left you in the mood for something unexpectedly twisted, you could do worse.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Thad Kirk, Dan Laughlin, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the possibility of war with Joel Brinkley, the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. And we meet jazz guitarist and singer John Pizzarelli. He got his start playing with a great guitarist, his father, Bucky Pizzarelli. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.